Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, what's up, everybody?
And welcome back to Mile High Podcast, episode 327. And this is, sadly, the last episode of 2024. Cannot believe it. This year really flew by. It's insane.
It's a sad day.
I know.
I'm gonna miss you.
We do miss you guys so much, but we take off 2 weeks every year for the holidays. It's good for us, good for our team. You know, a little recharge. We come back better than ever in 2025.
That's the goal.
That is the goal. I feel like it helps me a lot to have some time off and, you know, recharge. Spend time with our family, our daughter, you know.
Yeah, it's the holidays.
You guys should be off the, you know, computers and phones and everything too.
There's a lot of downtime during the holidays though, so people need podcasts, man.
I get it, because a lot of the podcasts that I love also take breaks over the holidays.
And then
I get
sad
and I have nothing to watch. So I get it, but we'll miss you guys and we'll be back before you know it. And also on that note, we wanted to say a big thank you to everyone who has supported our show, you know, this year, but throughout the years as well. You guys make it happen, and Mile High Media as a whole, Mile High Podcast, has had a fantastic year, and that would not be possible without all of you. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's been awesome. I mean, what a great year it's been. Mm-hmm. We got to cover a lot of very interesting topics and important cases, and, you know, thanks for taking the ride with us as we've evolved over the years. Mm-hmm. But tons of great content planned for 2025. We're only going to take it a mile higher from here. We say that every year.
That's right.
But that's the goal. So yeah, we'll be back July.
We're taking 7 months
I'm
off.
Taking a half a year of January 9th. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. We'll be back January 9th.
January 9th. Oh, and before we move forward too, I also wanted to remind you guys that our holiday matching program is still in effect until December 27th.
Correct.
You know? So any gift that you make towards Higher Hope is going to be doubled by us. Your gift goes twice as far, and we would really, really appreciate the support. We've got some big projects in the works for 2025 on the Higher Hope side of things, and we could use all the support we can get. So, and again, thank you to everyone who has supported it so far or has already made a donation to be matched. We are very, very grateful.
Absolutely. And we'll be able to share, you know, a lot of things are in the works. And so in 25, we'll be able to give you a lot more updates on some of the different grants that we've done so far and some of the very exciting things that the foundation's been doing.
So. And if you're curious of what we have been able to publicly share so far, you can head over to our Instagram account or our website as well. But our Instagram is higherhope.org.
Yes.
And we have a few posts of some cool projects that have been in the works. We just worked on a grief center down in Tennessee, and that's finally launched. And there's pictures of it in action, and it's really exciting to see. And that would not be possible without all of you, not only donations, but just supporting our shows. So yes. Huge thank you to all of you.
But yeah, with that being said, today's episode is covering the disappearance of Kelly Brannon. And this is a truly a mystery as to what happened to Kelly Brannon.
It is.
One that I'm still scratching my head about, and I haven't really been able to make up my mind on exactly what happened to her. Because there's a lot of different theories, and there's a couple persons of interest as well. There's no suspects in this case. She's just missing still.
Yeah.
So we're going to be covering that case. But before we get into that, last week, if you listened, we covered the UFO hearings. And of course, a few days after that all, you know, happened, we're now hearing reports of unidentified drone sightings, specifically over New Jersey and New York, in the thousands.
What?
There have been 3,000 at least reports that have been reported to the FBI of these unknown drones. And the military has already confirmed these are not our drones. Nobody knows who these drones are. And these drones range in sizes, which is so bizarre. So some of them look like, you know, the drones that we have, the little like consumer drones. But then there's people reporting there's drones the size of like vehicles.
Whoa, what?
Some of them are like 15 feet in length.
Huh.
And nobody knows whose they are. And it's just this mystery at this point.
Have you tried like shooting one down and seeing what it is?
Well, I think that's what we're going to have to start doing. But again, they're over cities like Brooklyn, over major cities in New Jersey. They're massive. So yeah, it's very dangerous. Yeah. But no, it's this whole mystery that they actually had the House committee actually had a hearing on this.
Oh, really?
Because obviously people are concerned, especially if you tell them that they're not ours. So whose are they?
Are they thinking it's probably foreign adversaries?
Well, that's one theory, but I mean, who really knows? And if we don't even know for sure if all of these are drones, in fact, but there's like swarms of them.
Wow.
And I think in the past we reported on unidentified drones in other parts of the country as well. But for some reason, there's this like hot spot going on over New Jersey and New York right now. And it's got people concerned. So it's a story that I'm certainly following because that's pretty frightening, honestly.
Yeah. Well, by the time this episode goes out, because we record about a week early, who knows?
Well, if there's any updates, if they figure it out, we'll post it below or somebody comment. But
show notes.
I just wanted to, because I've been getting blown up about it and I've been following it, as I'm sure many of you out there have. Especially following our UFO episode, I was like, oh, we got to mention this real quick. Yeah. But wild times we're living in.
Oh, to say the least.
My God.
What is 2025 going to bring?
I know.
We shall see.
But with that being said, let's go ahead and dive into the case of Kelly Brannon.
And before that, as always, just wanted to do a little shout out to our production team.
Okay.
Janelle, Ian, and then Tom, of course, too, who edits the
Tom.
Show.
Hi, Tom.
And thank you to all of you guys, too, for a great year and all the work that you've put in. We couldn't do this without you.
This show is awesome, and I'm so excited. Like, I can't believe thinking back to when it was just you guys in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just shooting the shit, you know, whatever, and now really it's this full-fledged podcast.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Operation, really.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, it's true. A full-blown operation we have going on here.
We're legit.
We're legit. Let's hope so.
Let's pat ourselves on the back a little more.
5 years later, hopefully we got things figured out.
Has it been 5 years? Wow.
Yeah, we're 18. Going. Yeah, 2018, dude.
Oh, yeah. So we're going on six. Dang. All right. So yeah, the Kelly Brannon case is super, super interesting. And there have been a lot of people really, you know, boots on the ground working really hard on this case. Some investigators and, you know, just journalists and things like that. But also just the community has really come out in large numbers for Kelly because she was such a loved person. And this case is just, like we said, such a mystery. So odd. She seems to have just vanished. And there's no really good lead or idea or theory that stands out above the rest. There's definitely, like Josh said, a person of interest that...
Several persons of interest.
Yeah, but I meant one specifically that has been kind of the main focus.
The person that was last with her.
Yep.
But I do want to give a shout out to Katie Kaplan, who's the local investigative journalist who really has done most of the reporting and investigation.
Very dedicated
on this case.
To the case.
And if you want to check out her podcast, it's Two Sleuths, which is, I listen to it, very good. So
yeah, they've got a two-parter on this case specifically, and it's excellent. Highly recommend it. They really deep dive and they have firsthand experience because she was out there for a lot of it.
Yeah, well, Ian reached out to her, and so they've been interacting over email about this case, we want to make sure that we're getting all of our facts right. Mm-hmm. And
she was able to give us some updates too.
See if there's anything new.
So yes, thank you, Katie. You are fantastic. Really admire your work and passion for this case. So Kelly Brannon had been really living a nomadic type of lifestyle throughout her 20s and 30s, spending, you know, months on the road, traveling from bar to bar, performing in various punk acts in her own one-woman band, which I think is one of the coolest things about Kelly is she is just so unapologetically herself, and just she does these live performances and they're awesome. She's so passionate. She has made tons of friends across the country. She's definitely someone you would want to be friends with. And she was involved in numerous protests as well. She's a big activist throughout 2010, everything from Occupy Wall Street to being in the front line on Standing Rock, protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline. But not only was she an activist and a musician, but she was also an artist in numerous fields and really just had a lot to offer the world. However, in 2020, Kelly was living on a farm in northern Florida, and she had earned a sizable amount of money after collecting a forgotten disability check. She had decided to purchase a home in Detroit and sort of put down her roots there with her boyfriend, Eddie Emerson. And in July of that year, she and Eddie began the long drive from Gainesville, Florida to Detroit, Michigan, with their cars packed to the brim with all of their belongings and their instruments, as well as Eddie's dog, Gordon, and their flock of 8 chickens. Kelly was a huge animal lover. But after Eddie's truck broke down in the small highway town of Live Oak, Florida, the two of them found themselves stranded while Eddie's truck awaited service. The weather was hot, and they spent days camping outside and sleeping in their cars. And as you can imagine, tensions were beginning to mount. And after deciding to rent a motel room, the two of them got into a very heated argument, and Kelly spent most of the evening drinking in the parking lot. After she left a voicemail on Eddie's phone, which you will hear later in the episode, at 12:59 a.m., she was never seen or heard from again. And 4 years later, after thousands of tips have rolled in, and there's been several potential sightings as well, also 6 persons of interest, people are still trying to answer the question, where is Kelly Brannon?
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Before we talk about the events leading up to her disappearance and the events after, let's talk a little bit about, you know, where she came from, her childhood to some extent. Although there's not a ton of information about her childhood, we've got some of the information that's been made public. But Kelly Brannon was born on May 2nd, 1984, and she grew up in Charlestown, New Hampshire. Charlestown is a population of only around 5,000 people, but within that small population was a vibrant local art scene with dozens of art galleries and DIY music venues lining the historic downtown and the scattered suburbs. And it's through this small art scene that close friends and family credit Kelly's lifelong love of the humanities. However, Kelly's life was marked early on by tragedy. Her father died suddenly of a heart attack when Kelly was only 5 years old. And this event, as you can imagine, was extremely traumatic for the family, that Kelly developed PTSD, actually, which she would suffer from for the rest of her life. Kelly did have a brother as well. However, he suffered from mental health issues of his own, and the two were really never that close. Instead, Kelly was extremely close with her mother, Chris, who was a teacher and developed mental health issues of her own following the death of Kelly's father. And throughout her life, Kelly has been extremely protective of her mother and has kept in contact with her nearly daily, even as she traveled across the country. So even as Kelly would travel and meet new people, she maintained close relationships with her childhood best friends like Cheryl Speak, who described Kelly as, quote, a true free spirit. And after graduating high school, Kelly bought a used car and an Atlas and spent a gap year traveling across the country. Halfway through the year, her car broke down, leaving her stranded. However, she was undeterred and continued to hitchhike from Mexico to Canada. Her desire for education also matched Kelly's free spirit. After her year of travel, she returned to the East Coast and got her bachelor's in fine arts at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design. She then received a master's degree in creative writing from Goddard College in Vermont. She's an excellent writer. Lots of poetry and other writing samples that you can actually see on her blog, which is still out there, and we'll of course have all that linked. But just a truly artistic, I think free spirit is the best way to describe her. She truly is a free spirit, just kind of goes wherever her heart takes her, you know, wherever mm-hmm. she feels like she wants to go, she just goes.
Mm-hmm. And says what's on her mind and is just very comfortable with who she is.
Absolutely.
So following school, Kelly continued traveling across the United States. And for a while, she was documenting her journey across various blogs and art projects as well. And while she was most known for her music, she also released short films, documentaries, photography projects, and also poetry booklets. So just a very well-rounded, very artistic person who was constantly expressing herself in whatever medium she wanted to at the time. Around 2009, Kelly settled in the Bushwick neighborhood in Brooklyn, where she would stay for the better part of the next 10 years. And it was here that Kelly became invested in her local community of artists. She would host an open mic night at her local bodega and a poetry and storytelling show called The Brews, and performing her solo musical act called The Baby Killers, where she would focus her lyrics on women's rights, injustices perpetrated by the state, and other issues that Kelly was a very fierce activist for. So just to give you an idea of some of the work that Kelly did, here is a pitch trailer with Kelly introducing her short film, Empty Spaces.
My name is Kelly Brannon, and I'm the writer and director of the film Empty Spaces. Empty Spaces is an art house dark comedy revolved around a group of rowdy and disenfranchised female artists who encounter a mysterious woman recently escaped from a mental institution.
I want to say quickly that if you guys are interested in that short film, there's a lot of clips from it, from Empty Spaces, on her Vimeo still. So you can watch it. It is pretty funny. It's a cool story. It's a really unique idea.
Yeah, it is. So can we link that below for people?
I think so, okay. Yeah.
Okay, we will do that. Activism was really central to Kelly's life, especially after moving to New York. In 2011, she spent weeks camped out at Zuccotti Park on Wall Street as part of the Occupy Wall Street protests. She was even a member of a march that consisted of Occupy Wall Street protesters walking from New York City all the way to Washington, D.C., to bring the protest to the nation's capital. She would even travel to Standing Rock in 2016 to protest the Dakota Access Pipeline, as we mentioned earlier, which threatened to overtake and ruin indigenous American land.
Kelly spent the longest period away from New York in 2015 when she moved into an abandoned property in Detroit, Michigan. The property included a Victorian-style mansion and a small structure she intended to fix up and turn into the, quote, the deserted street theater, named after all the other abandoned homes in the neighborhood. Kelly even planned a documentary during this time where she and her friend were going to hitchhike from the East Coast all the way to Los Angeles in order to attempt to meet filmmaker Vincent Gallo. However, this project and the Detroit house were canceled when Kelly had to return to her mother's house and help clean it after she had been experiencing a hoarding issue. After this, Kelly returned to her apartment in Bushwick. The next few years were stable for Kelly. She continued organizing open mics and poetry nights in Brooklyn and even formed a new band called the Friendly See You Next Tuesdays, another punk band with an activist intent.
Except it wasn't actually called See You Next Tuesday.
It was The Real World.
Yes.
Yeah.
But YouTube cannot handle that.
No, apparently they're a bunch of babies, but I love that name.
It's awesome.
However, in 2019, Kelly's Brooklyn sublease was about to end and she found herself at a crossroads. She could either remain in New York or hit the road again. So she decided to buy a van, a drum set, and a left-handed Stratocaster guitar. And Kelly sanded off the branding from the top of the guitar and set out on the road again, touring up and down the East Coast performing as the Baby Killers. Kelly stopped at open mic nights, small clubs and bars, and even performed in front of state capitals as she made her way south from New York.
Then in June of 2019, Kelly performed at a bar in Gainesville, Florida, where she met Eddie Emerson. Now, Eddie was 6 years younger than Kelly, but was also deeply involved in the DIY scene and was immediately just entranced by Kelly. He saw her as this badass, quote, raven-haired musician who immediately impressed him because she performed alone and with a left-handed guitar, which is pretty rare. I understand there's not many of these left-handed guitars out there, and it's a actually a pretty big element of this case. Yes. They're looking for this guitar now.
Right.
It's not in the same quantity as a right-handed guitar. Yeah.
Right.
Well, and it's also this specific one with the sunburst finish is extremely rare, is extremely rare.
But one fun fact about her guitar playing is that she only played the E string.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Which I don't understand what
that
means.
The low E string.
Help explain for those of us who are not musically
talented. So six strings on a guitar, and it's the thickest string, also the lowest note on the guitar. And so she would just play that all day long, you know, which you know, most people play all six strings. She'd only play one for whatever reason.
She's just unique like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely a unique way to play. So left-handed, only playing the low E string on the guitar. Which I think is interesting too, as we'll talk about it later on, that when you look, if you play a guitar for a long time, you can see the wear and tear from playing it. And so her guitar, not only is it a left-handed, you know, sunburst Stratocaster, but you could probably see that only the E string's been played and the other strings have not, because you can see wear on the actual strings themselves, on the fretboard and things like that. So could be another way to identify her guitar, which her guitar is missing and a big part of her of this case and her disappearance, which we'll talk about later, but just keep that in mind.
So Kelly and Eddie spent that night together, and they quickly became a very serious couple. They began touring together and found a place to live in northern Florida with Eddie's dog Gordon. However, this actually only lasted a short period of time because they lost their lease very quickly and eventually had to squat on a farm in Micanopy that was owned by a man that Eddie knew from Arkansas. And this is where their relationship really began to sour. Kelly had suffered PTSD ever since the death of her father and had become a heavy drinker to cope. And Eddie really only fed into this, drinking heavily as well, and was really unable to control his anger issues. And I can imagine it was much worse when he was drinking. They began arguing constantly, and soon these fights did end up becoming physical. And on December 26, 2019, police were called to respond to a domestic incident on the farm in Micanopy, where a couple had been arguing, and it sounded as though the man was hitting the woman. And when police arrived, they saw that Eddie had hit Kelly in the face, and she had sustained a black eye. Eddie was arrested and spent a week in jail before he was charged with battery and ordered to wear an ankle monitor.
Yeah, and there's body cam footage of this that was in the Never Seen Again episode that isn't anywhere else. And when you watch that, it's very tough,
it's very
tough to listen to, because you can actually hear her saying, ow, in it as the police come up to them. And you can see Eddie getting arrested in that. But I think it really just shows you how toxic this relationship was, and you know, how serious the physical abuse was getting. But despite this, Eddie and Kelly stayed together, but the relationship did not improve. Between April and May of 2020, police were called to respond to domestic incidents between the two 12 times. And some of these calls were placed by Kelly, who had a strong dislike for police. Some of these calls were also in response to more physical altercations between the two. But then there were some that were in response to alleged suicide attempts by Kelly, with one being so serious that it spurred the police to conduct a massive search throughout Micanopy. As you can imagine, with the police coming out as often as they were, the farm's owner was getting pretty sick of all the police attention that Kelly and Eddie were bringing to the farm and attempted to evict them from the property. He even threatened to drive from Arkansas to the farm and shoot them if they did not vacate the property. The situation was becoming volatile by the day. Eddie grew more violent, and the cops were coming by the property constantly. On top of that, the place they were squatting was not a house or even a farm building, but a structure with no running water. Kelly's friends were also becoming very worried about the relationship and about Kelly's well-being. That in the third week of May 2020, Cheryl Speak booked a plane ticket for Kelly to come home to New Hampshire and recuperate. Kelly spent the next 2 months back home with her mom and Cheryl. However, she stayed in contact with Eddie, and he flew to New Hampshire, where the two rekindled their relationship yet again. Kelly had filed a disability claim for her PTSD a few years back and had never collected on it. When she checked the claim in June, she had learned that it had grown to $6,000, and with this new sum of money, Kelly wanted a fresh start with Eddie. So she bought a 1982 Toyota Camry and planned on driving their belongings to Detroit, where they'd pick a home that they could purchase for $2,000 and fix it up. There was even talk of eventually leaving the country and moving to Iceland. And for Kelly, the money was an opportunity to finally settle somewhere again and give the relationship a fresh start.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
In July, Eddie flew back to the farm in Micanopy and began packing their things while Kelly drove her new car from New Hampshire to the farm. She stopped in Savannah, Georgia, where she knew some friends and spent the 4th of July there on the road. And she arrived back at the farm on July 8th, 2020. Then they packed up her car and Eddie's 1999 Toyota pickup with all of their belongings, instruments, Eddie's dog, Gordon, and the 8 chickens that they had been caring for while living on the farm. On July 9th, 2020, they hit the road, planning to camp along the way to Detroit. And unfortunately, they never made it out of Florida. Kelly and Eddie were only on the road for about an hour and a half before his car broke down. And upon inspection, they learned that his transmission was so broken that they would need to either replace it completely or refill it with transmission fluid every few minutes, which would obviously not be ideal for a road trip. Now, it's important to note that Eddie had very little money and Kelly wanted to conserve the $6,000 for when they got to Detroit to fix up the house. So they spent that night in their car and waited for AAA to arrive in the morning. And on July 10th, AAA towed Eddie's truck to Reese's Auto Repair Shop in Live Oak. And as previously mentioned, Live Oak is a small town near the Florida-Georgia border. And while not many people live there year-round, the traffic in the town could double its population.
It's kind of a town that you just kind of pass through, grab gas, mm-hmm. grab a bite to eat before continuing on. It's kind of like smack dab in kind of the center of the state, you know?
Yeah.
As you go, you know, we've driven across Florida before and, mm-hmm. you know, there's nothing in for miles. And then you'll just come across a town mm-hmm. where you'll stop for a break or refill and then head. But all, you know, all the major cities for the most part are on the coast of Florida. So
exactly.
Not a big town by any means.
Mm-mm.
I also just quickly wanted to note that 4 highways and interstates actually intersect in the middle of Live Oak.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's like you're saying, it is a huge road trip stop. You know,
okay. So tons of people pass through all exactly. the time. So the auto repair shop informed Kelly and Eddie that they did not have a replacement transmission for Eddie's truck, and they would either have to buy and ship one there or salvage a working transmission from a junkyard. So again, wanting to save money, they decided to stay in Live Oak for a few days and attempt to find a transmission nearby by calling auto repair shops and junkyards around the area.
However, Kelly and Eddie had 8 chickens to care for and tried to find a place to store them, which this is one of the wildest details of this case, is road tripping with 8 chickens. What
Quite
is that like?
Sounds fun.
I had 1 chicken in my house at one time.
I remember.
We raised a chicken from the egg in my basement.
Just one
for
on its
literally
own.
No reason other than I think my dad wanted to have that experience.
Wait, it lived inside your house?
Lived mm-hmm. in inside my house.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Slept on a couch.
Oh.
What was his name?
I don't remember that we named him.
Wasn't it Jimmy? Oh no, that was the guinea
that
pig.
That was my guinea pig. Yeah, I don't know what we just called him, the chicken.
Looking little.
Yeah, but I know how they're extremely messy.
Yes.
You know, so keeping 8 chickens in a dog kennel while you're traveling across the country, that's something not everyone would do.
Yeah.
So I commend them for doing that. That must have been kind of wild. But they're like, we got to go stay in a motel. Trying to sneak 8 chickens into a motel is going to be pretty tough.
That's pushing it, yeah.
You know, like you might be able to sneak 1 chicken in there potentially, but 8, like that's mm-hmm. wild.
Yeah.
You can't exactly potty train a chicken.
And tell it not to balk. Isn't that what they do?
Balk. Cluck.
Cluck.
Cluck, cluck, cluck. There you go.
That was just like that.
Good.
That
Thank perfect. You.
Thank you. That's one of my secret talents.
So Kelly and Eddie are trying to find somewhere to house their 8 chickens, you know, while they figure out the truck situation. So they stop by businesses in town, including a daycare, which I kind of see why you would try a daycare.
toddlers.
I got these eight cute chickens. You know, you can let the kids feed them and play with them.
Yeah, it can be like a Montessori experience.
Exactly. You know, bring a little petting zoo in there. So totally get that. So, you know, they're going around asking anyone that they can if they would be willing to take care of their chickens. At one point, while they were at a sandwich shop, they met a man named Alfredo and his friend who worked at a restaurant in town called Armando's. And the similar names have led to a lot of misinformation, just FYI. But it's important to note that Alfredo has no connection to Armando's. Alfredo took a liking to Kelly and Eddie and offered his farm for them to store their chickens. So they drove 20 miles to Alfredo's farm outside the town and stored the chickens in an unused coop. Eddie and Kelly then headed to Lake City, where they attempted to rent a room at a cheap motel. However, Kelly ended up getting into a heated exchange with the motel owner over the dog Gordon, who was not allowed to stay in the room with them. This got to the point where police were called, but luckily they ended the dispute and no police report was made. But because of the dog, they ended up spending the night in Kelly's car. The next morning, July 11th, Kelly and Eddie had breakfast at Waffle House in Lake City before returning to Live Oak. There, they spent the day walking around the historic downtown area and checking out the local shops. They bought a tent for $3 at a thrift store and even went to a frame shop where Kelly befriended the owner. They ended up drinking some wine together, and Kelly even drew a picture of Eddie. And it seemed like things were starting to settle down for the couple. And without telling Alfredo, Kelly and Eddie returned to the farm and in their new tent camped out next to the chicken coop.
The next day, July 12th, they drove to St. Augustine to check out a potential transmission for Eddie's truck. However, it was unfortunately not the right version. So they instead checked out the beach in the state park and camped there, which is not a bad place to camp. On July 13th, they found the correct transmission at a salvage shop in Lakeland, and they drove back to Live Oak and tried to give the transmission to Reese's auto repair shop, but the shop was closed when they arrived. So they left the transmission on the ground next to Eddie's truck and drove back to Alfredo's farm where they camped overnight. And the following day, July 14th, Alfredo's wife, who did not know that her husband had allowed them to camp on their property, discovered them sleeping next to the chicken coop, and she was not happy. So she forced them to leave and take their chickens with them. And when Kelly and Eddie arrived back at Reese's in Live Oak, the mechanics informed them that the salvage company listed the transmission incorrectly and that it wouldn't work in Eddie's truck. So major bummer. Kelly at that point just wanted to go ahead and get the truck towed back to Detroit and get back on the road. But Eddie said, quote, just give it one more night. And after a few days camped out in the humid Florida summer, temperatures were exceeding 100 degrees.
Humidity like 60, 70, 80%.
Oh, that's got to be
brutal.
Yeah. So they ended up, after a few nights of that, renting a motel room for $40 at the Sunshine Inn along the main highway. Kelly and Eddie were given the keys to room 70 on the far western edge of the Sunshine Inn, and they convinced a mechanic to help them sneak the chickens into the room while Eddie spoke to the front desk. However, when Eddie finished talking with the motel manager, Kelly had yet to bring the chickens into the room. And this sparked an argument between the two of them. Eddie tells Kelly that they should just keep the chickens outside in the grass, while Kelly wanted them to stay in the room with them. And the argument got so heated that Eddie threw his hat and said, quote, I'm sick of your stupid shit that you want to do.
By this point, Kelly was absolutely pissed at Eddie, and she ended up leaving the motel and drove into town while Eddie brought the chickens upstairs and then laid down in the room. At around 6:27 p.m., Kelly returned to the motel and began pacing around the parking lot. She and Eddie spoke on the phone for 1 minute, though it's unclear who placed the call. A minute after the phone call, Kelly sent a text that said, quote, right, well, good job keeping up the act for a few days. Kelly continued to text Eddie, saying that she hoped he enjoyed the room and that he could reimburse her later, before sending another text that said, his ex could come down and keep him company instead. At 6:34 p.m., Kelly sent two more texts, the first referencing how he only cared about his truck and that she had already spent $200 on his, quote, bullshit. However, the second text was deleted. The two continued texting, and Eddie responded with short texts that read, quote, "Sorry, could you bring back a pizza or something?" To which Kelly responded, quote, "Seriously, I'm not your fucking lassie. You're going to have to do better than that."
I think she meant lackey. Lassie?
Lassie, as in, you know, like Lassie the dog.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
But normally, like, when you have someone do stuff for you, it's lackey.
I guess that's true. I guess that's true.
I think either or could apply, probably.
Okay.
Lassie would bring you stuff.
I also will say you're not far off because looking through the text, there are a lot of grammatical mistakes.
Yeah.
She was drinking. At this point, she wasn't drinking that much. Yeah. But throughout the night, there are like a lot of grammatical written and spelling mistakes within the text.
Yeah, I think that's what that was.
Kelly seemed to warm up a little to Eddie after this, telling him not to let the chickens out before she showered, and said that if he wanted pizza, he'd have to dance for her and send pictures. Eddie then called his mom at 6:48 p.m. and their conversation lasted around 21 minutes, and it's unclear what they discussed on the phone. Kelly texted Eddie at 6:57 p.m. saying, quote, "Coming back with supplies, I'm expecting a dance." Kelly returned to the room later in the evening with a pizza and a bottle of wine. She sat on the other bed and Eddie hugged her. She said, quote, "You know I could have just gone back to New York myself," to which Eddie just responded, quote, "You go back to New York then." This created another argument, and Kelly grabbed the pizza and wine before leaving the room. Eddie said, quote, "Bye, see you next Tuesday," as Kelly left.
The real world. Kelly then continued to pace in the parking lot, eventually sitting with a group outside of the hotel, drinking the bottle of wine, and she continued to text Eddie, saying that he was using her and that his parents would help him out with money. At 7:22, Kelly sent two texts to Eddie. The first said, quote, "It's the same as the ankle monitor. You're all lovey-dovey when you have it on, and as soon as it's off, I'm the see you next Tuesday. You're all lovey-dovey when you think you have herpes, and as soon as his ex tells you she doesn't have it, I'm back to see you next Tuesday. I'm sick of being treated like shit." And the second text was also deleted and is missing from phone records. At 7:31 p.m., Kelly sent, quote, "I'm not going to be verbally punched by you anymore. Go find another girl that you can call see you next Tuesday, use and treat like shit. Why don't you save the insults for someone who deserves it?" Once again, the following text was also deleted and is missing from phone records as well. They continued to exchange messages. Eddie said that he needed to get Gordon's bowl and his phone charger from the car. However, Kelly's response was deleted and missing from the phone records. Then they continued to text, and Eddie said that his phone was about to die around 8 p.m. Kelly said that he had the charging cord, but Eddie said that he left the charging block in her car. Kelly then told him that he had the charging block, and they continued to text. There are multiple missing text messages, which is important to note as well. Eddie then knocked on the door to the room next door, a man named J.R. Bonnell, and he answered, and he asked J.R. if he could help him move the chickens downstairs since they had started smelling up the room. It'd be an interesting request to get someone's knocking on the door. "I got stinky chickens over here. I need you to help me move them."
Although I'm sure it's not the strangest thing that's ever happened at this motel.
No, probably not.
This is a, and just for context, this is a very, you know, picture perfect definition of like a roadside motel. It's you know, $40 a night. It's two levels. There's no pool. There's no, like, you know,
yeah,
landscaped grounds. It's just a simple
bare minimum
motel.
Yep.
And I will say that while this motel certainly, like, as we'll get into it, a lot of the people hanging around there had drug charges and stuff like that. It wasn't that seedy of a motel, especially when compared to a motel next door, which was known for having like known drug deals happen constantly. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of a rough area just in general.
Yeah. So Kelly saw them moving the chickens and she hugged Eddie and they seemed good again and tried to get the chickens back into the crate, but they could not get the last three in. I've heard it's pretty hard to wrangle chickens. And Eddie said that they should just leave them outside, and Kelly was not having that. She wanted to bring them all back upstairs. So the two of them argued again, and Eddie said, quote, "Good luck," before returning to the room and leaving Kelly outside. It's important to note that they needed a physical key to enter the room, and Eddie was the only one with a key.
Kelly then sent Eddie nine more text messages, five of which were deleted. At 10:30 p.m., JR knocked on Eddie's door and told him that Kelly, who was very drunk at this point, was trying to drive. So Eddie went downstairs, took Kelly's car keys, and returned to the room, locking her outside. At 10:51 p.m., Kelly sent, quote, "Thanks for ignoring me and locking me out, con man. I hope you're sending lots of hearts to all your old hookups." Kelly continued texting until 12:35 a.m. when Eddie finally responded, saying, quote, "Why don't you come to sleep?" To which she replied, quote, "Sure, they'll be proud you fucked this bitch once and for all and got a car out of it," referencing Eddie's family. Kelly continued texting until 12:59 a.m. when Eddie claimed he turned his phone off and went to sleep. He may have turned his phone off to conserve battery if he really didn't have his charger. Something to know. Kelly then left a voicemail on Eddie's phone. So let's listen to that voicemail.
And this is the last time Kelly was heard from by anyone, as far as we know.
"Oh, great. You're sleeping. I'm so glad I got that message from you before telling me how you're sorry and you love me and how you want me so much and all that bullshit just to get my car. Well, anyways, I've rented my own room at the Sunshine Inn and I've reported my car stolen and told them who stole it. So expect cops knocked at your door and I will be right next door at my own motel room because I'm not allowed to stay with you because I want to see you pay. Oh, you get the benefit because you only look out for you. It's your money. It's just for you. But my money's for both of us, essentially, with this bullshit. And I should obviously definitely do the Detroit thing on my own or go to Iceland. Like, you are not a partner. You're not a partner. You turn on me a second. You turn me out of nowhere. And I deserve way better. I did nothing to be called a fucking stupid idiot. And I did nothing to be called a So, you know, I'm sick of your abuse. So go find, oh, I'm going to get in a car right now. All right, bye."
Now that last part is important to note. "I'm getting in a car right now. All right, bye."
That night, witnesses reported seeing Kelly walking alone down the highway with her guitar towards the downtown area, though these sightings are unconfirmed. The voicemail is the last confirmed contact with Kelly Brannon.
"Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts."
The next morning, Eddie assumed Kelly slept in her car since there would have been no way for her to enter the motel room. He tried to call twice at 8:03 a.m. and 8:21 a.m., and at 8:54, he sent a text that said, quote, "What are you doing?" At around 9 a.m., motel surveillance footage shows Eddie checking Kelly's car for something. Inside, he would have found that Kelly's wallet and ID were still inside the vehicle. The only item missing was Kelly's left-handed Stratocaster guitar. Eddie then checked out of the motel, and on surveillance footage, it's clear that his dog Gordon is the only thing inside the car besides their belongings.
Then Eddie headed to the Live Oak Police Department to report Kelly missing. However, since she was, of course, an adult and could leave any situation that she wanted, especially given Eddie's history of domestic violence, there wasn't anything that they could do. However, Captain Jason Roundtree said that he had a strange feeling about Kelly and decided to put out a bolo for the surrounding police departments. In one of Kelly's texts from the previous night, she had mentioned that she was planning to return to the Micanopy farm to gather more of her things. Eddie ended up heading down there that afternoon to search for her. However, he did not inform her friends in the area that she was missing, only telling them after he returned to the motel in Live Oaks that evening. After a few days, the police began investigating Kelly's disappearance as a missing persons case, and Eddie became obsessed with finding her. He started the Missing Kelly Brannon Facebook page. He's really led up the whole page. And he used her credit card to print missing posters and called the LOPD nonstop, calling them up to 6 times in 1 hour. And these calls became so constant that Jason Roundtree said that he could have actually charged Eddie for interfering with the investigation.
Which is low-key suspicious to be calling so much.
I mean, you can take it that way. Or, well, you can take it as he's extremely worried and concerned.
Well, it's just interesting that Captain Roundtree's like, we could have charged him, mm-hmm. you know, just for being, you know, so annoying about this. But I understand the other side of it is he's concerned, right?
Yeah. Like, wouldn't you be annoying if I was missing? I mean, if it were true, I'd be calling true. As much as I can.
Yeah, I actually didn't really find that suspicious.
Yeah,
that
I don't
part at least.
I think it could be considered, depends on how you look at it, yeah. right? But I think there's that. I think many people in that situation would do that and probably have done it. And I think it's honestly a little extreme to say we could have charged him.
But I think from his perspective, knowing Eddie's history right. and knowing, you know, after talking to people around there, what was going on, you know, from Captain Roundtree's perspective, I think, you know, he's probably in his mind thinking he may be involved.
Yeah, yeah.
And from his prior experience, maybe be like, why is this guy trying to see where we're at with everything constantly? You know, is he trying to, you know, stay ahead of our next move? You know what I mean?
Or it can be seen as like staging concern.
Right.
So depends on how you look at it.
I also think it's important to note, we mentioned this later on, but LOPD only has about 20 officers on the force. So every single time Eddie calls, they have to follow up with it. And so I think that's more so what Roundtree is referencing, like interfering with the investigation by literally like stopping it every couple minutes.
Down.
Yeah, slowing it down intensely. Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense too.
Because he's also like feeding them information and things that he wants them to look at or do. And so that just detracts them from doing their own investigation or continuing it.
On July 17th, the police learned that Eddie was planning to drive back to his Massachusetts hometown with Kelly's car. Even though Eddie wasn't a suspect yet at this point, he was LOPD's strongest person of interest, and they needed an interview. The police conducted a three-hour interview with Eddie and obtained search warrants for their cars and belongings. And it has been misreported that LOPD gave Eddie a polygraph test, but that's actually untrue. Roundtree released Kelly's laptop and purse to Eddie, instructing him to give those items back to Kelly's mother. And it's unclear if he ever did. We're not really sure on that part. But 5 days after Kelly went missing, Eddie was on the road back to Massachusetts. LOPD was working the investigation, but it was extremely difficult. At this point, Kelly's disappearance had made national news, and they were flooded with thousands of tips, each of which had been followed up on individually. You know, that's quite a lot of work, especially when LOPD has only 20 officers on the force, as we just mentioned. So they investigated an area called Heritage Park, which Eddie directed them to, following a conversation with JR. They also searched the Micanopy Farm with cadaver dogs, but there was no trace of Kelly whatsoever.
And unfortunately, that's as far as the investigation went. LOPD followed tips in Georgia about potential sightings, but not much came of it. Overall, LOPD conducted 15 ground searches for Kelly and found nothing. LOPD generated 6 persons of interest, including Eddie and JR, who were all at the Sunshine Inn the night Kelly disappeared. However, none of these persons of interest have led to any leads into Kelly's whereabouts. So let's talk about potential theories here. For one, friends and family do not believe that Kelly willingly disappeared, because, you know, I think that's one of the most likely ones, especially based on the circumstances. You know, she was fighting with Eddie. Her voicemail says, I'm thinking about just going to Detroit on my own and doing this thing by myself. But the thing about this theory is that Kelly was extremely protective of her mother and would not have gone years without speaking with her to ensure that she was okay. She would not have just like up and left and stopped contacting any of her friends and family. Aside from Eddie, JR is the most suspicious of the 6 persons of interest. Now, most of the suspicions at JR came from Eddie himself. While Eddie was still in Live Oak, JR told him that Heritage Park was the most likely place for someone to go missing. However, when they arrived, it was clear to Eddie that JR just wanted a ride to the park for him to buy drugs. Which I just wanted to mention, JR is a convicted felon, so keep that in mind. When Eddie checked out of the Sunshine Inn, he asked JR if he could store his musical equipment in his room. JR agreed, but when Eddie returned, all that musical equipment was gone. When Eddie returned, he found out that JR had pawned off all the equipment. Police were able to recover it, and Eddie decided not to press charges, which it's important to note here. If JR was involved with Kelly's disappearance, wouldn't he have tried to pawn off her guitar as well? Eddie claimed that JR tried to get Kelly to enter his room while she was pacing around the parking lot, but this is unconfirmed. JR told LOPD that he had gone to bed shortly after he told Eddie that Kelly was trying to drive her car around 10 or 11 p.m. However, other people hanging out in the parking lot saw JR out and about much later than that, and nobody saw him leaving with Kelly. LOPD forensically searched Eddie and JR's motel rooms, but this was a month after Kelly's disappearance and both rooms had been cleaned multiple times. LOPD did collect a few items, but they didn't lead to anything.
Now, there are two big pieces of misinformation that have been widely spread when it comes to Kelly's case. For one, that Armando's restaurant had something to do with it. And this came from the fact that the man who let them use his chicken coop, Alfredo, was with someone who worked at Armando's when he met Kelly and Eddie. And while they did eat at Armando's while they were in Live Oak, the restaurant having any connection to her disappearance is just not true. And when the private investigators who were looking into Kelly's disappearance arrived at Armando's, those working there got up and refused to speak with them. And while some say that this is suspicious, it's more likely that they just didn't want to talk to people that they thought were with the police. Armando's was known as a sketchy place with drug deals and an illegal nightclub that was run after hours, but the restaurant was never involved in human trafficking or anything like that. The other big piece of misinformation is that Kelly's phone pinged off of a cell tower in downtown Live Oak at around 2 a.m. However, this is unconfirmed. Eddie found this information from a woman who advertised herself as a missing persons expert online. Eddie granted this woman access to Kelly's laptop and Gmail, and when she saw that Kelly's Gmail synced with the cell tower, she assumed that it had pinged. However, Captain Roundtree, who had information from the cell phone companies, could not recreate this ping, and the woman's information was just inaccurate. So at this point, as you can imagine, most people's suspicions are really starting to turn to Eddie. And it's important to note that throughout the investigation, Eddie was cooperative and underwent 13 hours of interviews with LOPD. And like we mentioned earlier, his constant interference with the case could have just been out of genuine concern. And after turning his phone off right before Kelly left, the voicemail could have just been a coincidence.
Before we talk about Eddie any further, though, I wanted to play a little clip of an interview that Katie Kaplan did, the journalist who's been heading up this case, did with him a few days after Kelly disappeared. So let's play that.
For hours, Kelly threatening to leave.
She's texting me and calling me, and I'm answering and hanging up because it's just mean stuff. She's getting drunker and drunker. I'm just trying to sleep.
This surveillance video shows one of the last known times Kelly was seen walking through the parking lot of the Sunshine Inn, just a few hours before a final voicemail from her.
Wow.
It ended like this.
Oh, I'm going to get an hurt now.
Those words 10 months ago, detectives say the last known from her.
When talking about Eddie, one thing that is kind of interesting is the fact that he didn't contact Kelly's friends in Micanopy the day after she disappeared to see if she was with them, which is very strange because Kelly was known to stay with friends in Gainesville after they fought, and he never reached out to them until he was back in Live Oak. Again, I think one could argue maybe that wasn't just at the top of his mind. But again, he's out there seemingly desperate to find her. Why wouldn't he contact her friends almost immediately?
It just seems like a no-brainer that you would just do
right.
That, you know, especially when you're trying to think of every possible option, you'd think that would come to mind. But again, yes, you can make the argument that he's overwhelmed and just didn't think to do it. But I don't know. Let us know what you guys think on that.
Another thing that's kind of interesting that, you know, it's hard to say for sure. One of Kelly's audio engineer friends has said that the voicemail that she left may have been doctored. This friend put that voicemail into audio software called Isotope, where they could identify a point in the recording that appeared to be a splice or a digital change. The cut was too clean to be ambient or analog. The only explanation other than editing the audio is that the cell network may have glitched. So this one, I think people kind of go back and forth. There hasn't been like a forensic expert who's looked at the audio to, you know, really examine it.
Right.
There's just somebody who does audio engineering. One important thing to note, though, is that Eddie was experienced with audio software. Being a musician, recording his own music, it is possible he could have done something like that. Right.
I do, from Katie, I have this answer. I asked her directly about if she thought it was doctored, and she said Quote, possible yes, probable no. When you listen to arguments in favor of that theory, it can be compelling, but in my experience covering murder cases, I feel it is unlikely given when she was last seen on camera and when the voicemail came through on Eddie's phone. If she was murdered in a crime of passion and the voicemail is part of a cover-up, then the alleged killer would have had to either have the recording already made or have acted pretty quickly under duress. So,
yeah, I think it's very unlikely.
Out of all the things that a killer would need to do, are they going to spend that time doctoring some audio? Another interesting thing to bring up is that there have been thousands of potential sightings of Kelly that have been reported, but they have not led anywhere. A homeless woman seen in Baja, Mexico has a striking resemblance to Kelly. Those involved with the case went to Baja and spoke to the woman, whose voice slightly differed from Kelly's when she was last seen. We don't have that audio or anything like that to show you, but the woman was photographed and the similarities are uncanny. I mean, if you look at the picture side by side,
very,
very similar down to like the hairstyle, you know?
And like the smile, the nose.
Yeah.
The nose is a little bit different, but like the eyes.
Seems to have a thinner bridge.
Mm-hmm. But that could also just be like the lighting.
Yeah.
The photo that we're showing you of this woman in Baja is, I think, a like cropped in, zoomed in version of the original photo, which Katie Kaplan has seen. And one thing that she brought up was Kelly has an anarchy, or like the anarchy A, tattooed on her hand, and you could kind of see
almost like on her palm.
Right. Is it on? Yeah.
It's on the underside.
And so in the original photo of this woman in Baja, you are able to see her hands, but there's no tattoo. But again, it could just be the camera angle, which could make it be, you know, difficult to fully see that location. But the authorities looked into this woman for several months. I believe Captain Roundtree, they contacted the consulate down there and they had a local organization or something go and
people in
talk to this woman and take photos. And he has even said that it was like really this woman's voice that was pretty telling. It just was very different from Kelly's voice.
They said higher pitched. Yeah.
So Captain Roundtree is confident that the woman in Baja was not Kelly Brannon. But yeah, very similar.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
So it has now been over 4 years since Kelly Brannon went missing in Live Oak, Florida. Captain Roundtree did give an update about the case last year, and he stated that the case still hasn't gone cold, which is good news. We also did get an update as well. Ian, if you want to jump into that.
Yeah, so you'll see this event that that was held in 2023 reported as an update into the case. In reality, I reached out to Katie, and she was at this event, and what she said was, the event was hosted by Suwannee Valley Unsolved, which is a local nonprofit that raises awareness about cold cases. And it was more of a presentation of the case to the public by investigators who went over the timeline and answered questions from the public. Some of Kelly's friends were there in person via live stream and had the opportunity to ask questions directly of the investigators. There was no new information released, but my notes, Katie's notes, from the event do highlight some interesting logistical details. They interviewed roughly 24 people who were involved at the motel that day, and they did at least 4 interviews with Eddie that collectively lasted more than 14 hours. As far as I know, as far as Katie knows, the investigation is still ongoing, and Katie firmly believes that the investigator would have let her know if there was any change in the case, because it is very personal to Jason Roundtree.
Yeah. And didn't she give you an update on the chickens as well?
Oh, yes. So that's the other thing, is that it's not really reported what happened to the chickens after all this. But according to Katie, she said that Eddie left them behind at the Sunshine Inn and they were still hanging around the motel a few months later.
Wow. Motel chickens. That's pretty crazy. He would just leave them.
I know.
Especially because they were so important to Kelly that that's really such a slap in the face to her. You know, that's what she would have wanted. I don't know, that really bothers me.
I mean, and especially since that is what ended up leading to her disappearance, is this massive fight.
Right.
You know? You would think out of guilt, you would do that.
Right.
That's, I don't know, that's odd. Also, this is some unfortunate news. Kelly's mother, Chris, did pass away in 2023. And this really confirmed to Kelly's friends and family that she was not willingly missing, because she definitely would have seen her mother before she passed. And there's one piece of evidence in Kelly's disappearance, and it's the only belonging that is missing from her car, and it's her guitar, as we mentioned earlier. And LOPD has told people to be on the lookout for Kelly's left-handed Stratocaster guitar with the branding sanded off. So if you're in the music scene or have friends in the music scene, check in with them, see if anyone has seen this guitar, because it could be something that cracks this case wide open. And of course, anyone with information about Kelly Brannon's disappearance is asked to call Captain Jason Roundtree of the Live Oak Police Department at 386-362-7463. And important to note, anonymous tips can be made through Suwannee Valley Crime Stoppers at 386-208-8477.
To wrap up this episode, let's kind of go over the different theories here and different options that could have happened, because I think when you hear everything, I think most of us naturally gravitate towards Eddie. I think because of his history and the fact that they were, you know, kind of fighting off and on, and the last text conversations they were having, and then her voicemail, I think it's very clear that she was very upset with him. She's, you know, basically saying, I'm going to leave you. I'm going to go do this on my own. I'm going to go to Detroit. And I don't need you. I don't want you anymore. And I think based on statistics with domestic violence, we know that in a lot of cases, the one closest to the, you know, the victim in these types of situations is the one who's done it. Again, no evidence of that with Eddie, but I think most of us just kind of lean that way naturally because we know this. However, I do have to trust that the investigation that Captain Roundtree and the Live Oak Police Department's been doing, and it seems like they've done a really good job, a really thorough job. Yeah. They've done searches of the area. And I think, yes, there's still some questions on, did he actually just go to sleep? Did he actually just like stay in the motel that night? And we have no way of knowing for sure what happened after he sent that last message and said he went to bed. We have no idea. So is it possible he was still potentially involved in some way, shape, or form? Yes. But again, there's no evidence to back that up. And he has said himself that he had nothing to do with her disappearance. He's also been asked, did you murder Kelly? And he has said no. I do think it's interesting, though, that a polygraph test hasn't been administered, although that would be totally voluntary. And most people are going to decline that because of, you know, they're not always reliable and they're not admissible in court. So I get that. It would be interesting, though, if he would voluntarily take one, because just be interested to see what the results are. I think the more likely scenario here is I go back to JR and I go back to this motel, the area of town of which it's in. I did a little research. Live Oak, just in general, has a very high crime rate and a very high violent crime rate. Not only that, human trafficking is a major problem in Florida, especially in these major, you know, major cross sections of interstate highway. You know, that's where human traffickers target their victims, is in these areas, because they can get out of town very quickly and it's like they were never there. So those two scenarios come to my mind as well. The thing about JR that's interesting is that Katie Kaplan did a background check on JR, and he has a rap sheet that includes a history of violence, and he's actually currently in jail for not only drug charges, but also for possession of a weapon by a felon. So I think that gives you a little bit more information on who this guy is, and is he capable of doing something to Kelly? And in my opinion, I think absolutely, because you have to also remember, he was kind of making advances at her. you know, he's like inviting her to come into his room and stuff. And maybe it's one of those situations where he got upset, or maybe they had some type of interaction later on. Again, he just said, oh yeah, I was in my room at 10 or whatever. But even Eddie has said himself, he's like, nobody goes to bed at 10 o'clock at this motel. Everybody's night, you know, mm-hmm. everybody's out at night hanging outside the motel. There's drug deals going on. So it's very possible that JR then never went to bed at 10, like he said, and he came back out. Because one of the unfortunate things with this particular case is that their surveillance footage, there was multiple cameras at this motel, but only one camera was working.
As always.
Yeah. And from this camera view, you can't see Eddie and Kelly's room. You can't see like people coming in and out of it. So there's no, the police have a very difficult time here trying to confirm these stories. There's no way to really confirm them other than possible other witnesses that were there. How do we even know that Kelly even got into a vehicle in the first place? She said it, but... I'm getting into mm-hmm. a car. But how do we know for sure? She had also been drinking in excess that night. So
I don't know, though. In that voicemail, it really did sound like, because you can tell the car had like pulled up and she's like, oh, and I'm getting into a car right now. Bye. It sounded like she was like literally about to get in. But yes, you're right. We don't know for sure. So is your theory then that JR was driving that car?
It's possible. I mean, when you think about that situation, and again, it's hard to tell how inebriated she is, because how many people are just going to get into a random car with a random stranger? Or was it somebody that she had had prior contact with?
But she also has hitchhiked plenty of times in her life, so she was fairly comfortable with
that.
Doing
is true,
like,
and
that.
I guess she didn't have her keys, so maybe that's
she's such a free spirit. I could see her easily doing something like that.
And she was clearly pissed at Eddie, so yeah. Could it have been she's walking around, she's pissed off, someone's like,
"You need a ride?
Yeah. How's it going?" Yeah. She's like, "Oh, my fucking boyfriend, you know, whatever."
Yeah,
and they're like, "Oh, well, come hop in my car," and she. You know, she's under the influence. She's really angry. She could have been like, okay, you know.
Or maybe it was a situation where she had talked about taking this drive with whoever it was. And then while she was waiting for them to get their car, she makes the call. Then they pull up. But yeah, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I feel like whoever was driving that car was likely involved. But I don't know. It could have happened days later after she went wherever she went. Or she really could be out there. It seems so, I agree with her friends and family. The chances of that are so slim. I don't think she would have done this to not only her family, but she had so many close friends and she's just such a good soul, such a good hearted person. I don't think she would put people through this for
and
no
she
reason.
She was super close with her mom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, she had lost her dad, and when her mom got sick, you would think that she would have, you know, come to see her. And obviously maybe not, but.
Well, of course, there is the possibility that she did suffer from some mental health issues as well. Is it possible that she had some type of break where like she doesn't even know what's going on and is somewhere on the streets and isn't aware of even who she is? I mean, there's always that possibility as well. So you can't say for sure that she's not still alive and out there somewhere. That's what's so frustrating is there are so many different possibilities. And of course, going back to Eddie, you know, I'd feel terrible for him if he really didn't have any involvement. And he treated her horribly. There's no excuse for his behavior, but all of that doesn't mean that he committed this murder. And of course, he has had some sketchy behavior, and I'm not defending him by any means. I mean, personally, I think there's a good chance he's involved, but how horrible would that be if that was all put on you? So I'm just not comfortable saying either way what I think happened, because we just don't have, there's not enough evidence in any direction you really look at.
Yeah, I think the one thing that sticks out to me though is she had this money waiting for her.
Right,
and if she did, and she also, yes, she was drunk that night, but she drank a lot all the time. So, mm-hmm. and honestly, from the voicemail, it seems like she's still fairly, you know, with it and still like processing what's going on. It wasn't like she was like slurring her words to the extent you can't understand what she's saying, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So to me, it's like she was conscious enough to be able to say the things that she wanted to say. All right, I gotta go. I'm getting in this car. And so in my mind, if she did get in a car, she was either taken by somebody who was a complete stranger that she flagged down or something, or it was somebody that she had met prior, maybe in Live Oak somewhere, because it seemed like they had just been like going around town talking to random people and and they kind of, she kind of seems like the person who'd maybe divulged too much information about herself, and she's looking for people to watch her chickens. And this is a, seedy area. Yeah. There's a lot of crime going on. There's a lot of bad people in this area. And to a predator, here is a vulnerable person, right?
Yeah.
And so for a predator, this is the perfect victim. Mm-hmm. And so
especially someone that's distressed and possibly intoxicated. Right. Yeah.
And to me, it has everything to do with the location. I mean, she's been nomadic for a long, long time. She's been going all over the place. And that also sticks out to me and kind of leads me back to Eddie for that very fact that she's pretty experienced in being a nomad and going and probably has been to a lot of shady areas and seedy motels and met seedy people. But yet the way this all unfolds, in my mind, is almost too convenient in a way. And the way that Eddie kind of describes how things happened almost feels like a little too perfect to me. Mm-hmm. And I think the issue is that there's just no evidence to go off of that leads you farther down that road, as far as Eddie being involved in her disappearance. And I think that's the most difficult part, is unless Eddie knows something that he's not telling people.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who pieced together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
And he comes out and says it, or somebody else comes forward with some information that somehow, because if you think about it, him pulling this off also seems very difficult too.
Yeah.
In the time period that this all happened. Mm-hmm. So maybe somebody out there saw something else that happened or knows more about what happened after 12:59 a.m. after that last text was sent.
Yeah.
Did Eddie just go to bed, or was Eddie out and about or going after her?
Mm-hmm.
He says, I locked her out and I went to bed, and he regrets that decision because he knows that something happened to her.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's one of those where it's hard to draw any sort of conclusions because there's just not enough information there.
I also think it's worth thinking about that this motel required physical keys. And so you couldn't, we've talked about cases where you can look at the history of the fob and when it's being used and when someone's going in and out. But this, I would assume, probably doesn't have that.
Yeah.
Just for the fact that it's also a, cheap motel, and he was the only one with the key,
and nothing like that has been reported.
Right, exactly. So it's like, how do we really know, like Josh said, that he went to bed?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know.
There's no way to know, and there's one camera working.
Right.
Somebody who stayed at this motel may know exactly how far that camera can see.
Well, we have a diagram of it.
Right. True. So there you go.
The surveillance camera, the only thing the surveillance camera proves, because in fact, like, if you look at the diagram, where everyone was hanging out is on the like opposite side, like completely not being recorded. The only thing that the security camera proves is that, it's right there. So like they were all hanging out underneath the awning, like kind of by the front area there. So the only thing that the camera proves is that Kelly's car did not leave the parking lot after she returned with the pizza and the wine, and that she was seen pacing on it twice between 8 and 9 p.m. So, but her car stayed there throughout the night. So we know that she didn't get into her car. I also think and also Eddie stole the key from her. I also think it's important to note with JR, the claim that he tried to get Kelly into his room, that came from Eddie, and that also came from Eddie in a later interview. It wasn't in the first interview he did with Katie.
No.
Not to say that it's not inaccurate, but I think it's important to say that. And the final bit of information I think that's important just when it comes to theorizing all this is that if we are thinking if she got in the car, like for real, she did lie in that voicemail saying that she got her own room at the Sunshine Inn. She said, yeah, I have rented a room, and she didn't. There's no record of that.
Yeah.
So there is a
That's
chance.
A good point.
Yeah. I think there is a chance that she was just kind of saying that to rile him up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people claim at the end of the voicemail, you can hear someone begin to say a word that starts with the letter N, like no, but it cuts off right after that click. So there is a chance she was with someone else. It also could have just been other people in the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, if we're to believe the sightings later on at night, again, the cell phone ping is not credible at 2 a.m., but if we're to believe those later sightings that she was seen walking through the downtown area, it leads me to think that whatever happened to her, if she was taken by someone else, I think it may have occurred after she had left the hotel, the motel, mm-hmm, and started mm-hmm. walking towards town. And then maybe someone just saw it as a crime of opportunity.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because the PIs don't necessarily think that.
Right.
They don't believe that it was just like somebody passing through, you know, this town and saw
transient.
Her and just like, yeah, some yeah. transient and picked her up mm-hmm. and took her out of there. Which is interesting and I think leads back to Eddie, in my opinion. Like there's more to the story here.
Yeah,
than what we have.
I certainly get those vibes from him. It's so hard to say. Like I said, I really don't want to.
No, and I'm not saying he did anything, but I just think
it's sketchy.
It's very sketchy.
And there, what was the episode? There's an episode on this. It's really well done.
Never Seen Again.
Never Seen Again. Yeah. Right. Thank you. There's a lot of interview. He's in that, and there's interviews with him, and I found it so hard to get a read on him. There were moments where I felt like, oh no, he didn't do this. You can tell he's really fucked up over this. And then there were moments where I was like, I don't know, maybe he really did.
Yeah, I think specifically in the Never Seen Again, my kind of read on that is they were taking, because when they discussed the domestic violence incident on December 26, 2019, he said that he pushed her and he hit her face that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas when you look at the photograph of her with the black eye, it's pretty clear that that's like
a closed fist, most mm-hmm. likely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think that in the Never Seen Again, because they had him as an interview, they really didn't want to push suspicions towards him, which I can understand, especially
you want him to work with you.
Yeah. And as a journalist, like you don't have
True.
Anything to go off of, you know, it's
yeah.
kind of,
mm-hmm.
so I think they were kind of going with his word, but that episode also said that he passed a polygraph.
Yeah. That there's some incorrect information.
Yeah.
There.
And they spread the Armando's thing mm-hmm. and reported the cell phone ping as legitimate. So
yeah, it's always so surprising to me when big productions do things like that. Like,
right.
Really? Come on, fact check. It doesn't take that long. But yeah, I mean, it is an interesting episode. And it has a lot more clips of Kelly and other friends in her life and stuff. And I mean, it seems like most people in her life and most people that have just followed this case too really lean towards him. But yeah, at the end of the day, there's just not solid evidence. He did say in the episode, he admitted to calling her a see you next Tuesday. He said he felt horrible about it. Because in her voicemail, she also said that he called her stupid
He called her stupid. And then the actual quote from, at least according to Eddie, is that I'm tired of all this stupid shit you
stupid
do.
Shit, yeah. So I don't know. I think it's interesting if you're interested in the case, it's kind of interesting to watch that mm-hmm. episode just to at least hear from him and kind of get a read on him for yourself. But yeah, it's terrible.
Hard. It's just hard to ignore the history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
And it's hard to ignore statistics around domestic violence
mm-hmm.
and outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what gets me. I think there's absolutely a possibility that could have been somebody, you know, involved in some type of human trafficking ring or sex mm-hmm. trafficking ring that mm-hmm. could have saw her as a victim because, you know, they saw her as a vulnerable person and inebriated and took advantage of that, possibly. But again, it's hard to ignore everything else that we know.
Yeah.
And it's hard to believe his story. And that's the problem with this case is that the only things we know is because of Eddie. Pretty much.
Right. And he really has like led up a lot of the search for her and like ran the Facebook page. And you can look at that two different ways. Either he's very concerned and, you know, trying to do everything
constantly
he can
for updates.
Yeah. And it's just the same thing there. But then you know, on the other side of the coin, sometimes
yeah, in other
seen
cases,
people do
the
that.
Killers doing that.
Yep. Yep. And doing interviews too.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
And it's important to note as well that Eddie no longer runs the Missing Kelly Brandon Facebook page.
Right, that was taken over by...
I'm not sure who runs it now.
I can't remember who either, but yeah, not him anymore. It's definitely for
the best. Yeah, he's like off the grid now. He's like, he's back in the Northeast, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of just staying offline.
Yeah, I don't know if he's off
not
the
really
grid.
No, I'm not. I meant that like, as a figure of speech, but
off the radar more.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Which, you know, you can and take that two different ways.
Saying
too.
He's trying to stay out of the drama and stuff. And,
which, like, you again, I can't.
Which you can see both sides. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to make excuses for him.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think he's the greatest dude ever, but I think if you've been through. If you really didn't do anything and thousands or hundreds, probably thousands of people have accused you of doing something so horrible to someone that you cared about, it would make me want to you know, get
disconnect,
off.
Because
that's pretty horrible. But then you can look at it the other way, that he's wanting to lay low and that's for a reason. So,
oh, shoot.
Yeah, it's just really hard to really say at the end of the day. I don't feel comfortable really aligning with any theory or person.
My computer just died. I was about to read this. There is in the email from Katie, there is an update. I asked her, are there any updates about Eddie? And her answer, I think would be good to read right about now.
Okay.
I was about to read it, but then
I got it. What does she think about the theories surrounding Kelly's disappearance? And Katie Kaplan said, this case is so compelling, as there are so many potential outcomes of what may have happened that cannot be ruled out at this time. Sometimes I lean one way, and then the next day I will lean another. From what Live Oak PD has told me on several occasions, they do not even know if she is dead or alive. Was she murdered in a crime of passion by her boyfriend with a history of domestic abuse? By a sordid figure at the seedy motel took advantage of a vulnerable woman? By a psychopath who just happened to be driving by or passing through the transient town late at night? Is she being held in someone's basement? Or was she sold into a sex trafficking trade that plagues this part of the country? Did she die by suicide in a rural field nearby? Or did she skip town deciding she was fed up with her life and just doesn't want to be found? Or did this woman with a history of mental health issues and past traumas have a mental break and is just lost, waiting to be found? Maybe only one or two people in the world know right now, which is why we need to find her. If she was in fact murdered, that means there is a killer on the loose walking amongst us and the people we love. Yeah, I think all of those are possible.
Yeah.
Which is just makes this so frustrating and why hopefully there'll be some type of lead or tip in the future that kind of breaks this case open.
Yeah.
So.
Horribly sad.
Yeah.
Kelly seemed like an awesome person. She really did. A special human, a rare type of human. And I just really feel for her family and friends who, I mean, when you have someone like that in your life, she was described as such a good friend, such a good soul. That's such a major loss for so many. And I think it's powerful. It shows just how loved she was, that there are so many people, you know, doing everything they can for Kelly. And I just hope one day for all of them and for her family that they get those answers, because it's the not knowing that's just got to. I just really can't imagine what that
would
be like.
Yeah, it eats away at you.
It's just horrendous. But yeah, we would love to hear from you guys, your theories. And again, if you have any tips, make sure you get that to the right people. We will have all that information linked below. But that is going to be it for today's episode and it for the year. Can't believe it. Thank you so much for joining us today and all the other episodes that you tuned in for the year. It means so much to us.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. Well, happy holidays first and then...
True. Yeah. Let's get through the holidays first, but
2025. Insane. Can't believe it.
Well, we'll see you in 25.
Mm-hmm. We certainly will. Here's to another great year ahead. But yeah, that's it. I forget what we say. How do we end this?
Keep on taking your mind a mile higher.
But until then,
keep on taking your mind a mile higher.
That.
Hi there. My name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.